The world's most powerful solar telescope, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. We'll climb into the mountains of Southern California to visit a telescope that sits in the middle of a lake, and we'll meet the man whose name is now on that great instrument. Bill Nye is back, and so is senior editor Emily Lakdawalla, as you're about to hear. And Bruce Betts will wish the Curiosity rover a happy fifth anniversary on Mars in this week's What's Up segment. Emily, a little eclipse gift from you to your many readers at planetary.org, where you have posted this blog about a really simple and, most important, a very safe way for people to view the Great American Eclipse coming August 21st.
Or any eclipse, for that matter. I was motivated to write this post because I've seen so much emphasis on being in a place in the United States where you can see totality, and on, you know, buying the right eclipse glasses and equipment and filters and whatnot. And for me, I'm more interested in educating as many people as I can. And not everybody's going to be able to travel, so that most people will be seeing a partial eclipse, and not everybody will have planned ahead and bought eclipse safe eclipse sunglasses. So I like this activity because it is incredibly cheap. Most people have the materials, necessary materials on hand, and it's safe for even the youngest children.
So tell us about this. It is a pretty famous way of viewing, indirectly viewing eclipses.
All you need is a pin and a couple of cards. You punch a hole, a very small hole, in one of the cards with a pin, and you make yourself a pinhole projector. And what looks like just a dot, an image of the hole on your second card, is actually an inverted image of the sun. And so during eclipses, little holes punched in things, or holes made by tree leaves overlapping each other, all of those things will become projections of the shape of the sun, and they'll all turn into little crescents. It's quite magical.
And you have this step-by-step guide for how to create these. It even includes some examples of some wonderful artwork, a little gallery of eclipse pinhole projectors by some people you know.
Yes. Well, I'm a teacher first, and so I want to make sure that this activity is one that can be done by teachers, and that it's a good classroom activity. And a good classroom activity is not just to punch one hole in a card. So I thought about what else could we do, and I said, oh, we can make some artwork. So kids can draw designs and then punch out holes around the edges of the designs, and their little designs turn into artworks with projected eclipses during the eclipse. It's a really fun activity, good for manual dexterity for little hands. Really fun to do with kids and teachers.
Lots of photos in this blog post and artwork from your daughters, we should say, and their cousins, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's Emily Lakdawalla. You can check out all of the Planetary Society's activities and guidelines for viewing the eclipse wherever you might be at planetary.org/eclipse. Emily, thanks very much and happy viewing.
Thanks. I look forward to it.
Bill Nye is back. He's the CEO of the Planetary Society. He's been a little busy lately making a TV show, but we're glad you still care about radio.
Radio is the most visual medium, Matt.
It's all in your mind. Speaking of which, what's on your mind? There were some great stories in the First Up column from Space News on Monday, the 31st of July.
Well, there's always something, Matt, but there are a couple things. First of all, you know, good old vinyl cyanide. I know. What are you talking about? So astrobiologists have given it deep thought, and they believe if your world is methane, as is Saturn's moon, your cell wall would not be made of lipid proteins, as we might have here on Earth, but our good friend vinyl cyanide. Cyanide? With living things? Bill, that's crazy. No, these people, have given it deep thought, and they think it's possible. So when you detect vinyl cyanide chemically with their telescopes on another planet, that'd be our planet, you think, well, maybe there's something alive there. It really is another just fantastic and intriguing possibility. And it's one more thing, Matt. We guarantee you that what's really going on in the solar system is stranger and more remarkable than you might have thought. I'm saying that right now. What is it, 2017? When life is found elsewhere in our solar system, it will astonish us.
Which is one of the things that makes it so thrilling to talk about this kind of stuff with you. As you said, there's much more. I guess NASA has explained why we're not going to put people on the first big space launch system rocket.
Well, Matt, as you know, I am not a middle manager at NASA.
Lucky you.
They're telling everybody that it would cost anywhere from $600 to $900 million to put people on the first space launch system. Now, the space launch system has some engines that were used on the space shuttle, so people think it's generally reliable. But would you be the guy to get on the first space launch system? Yeah. Go beyond the moon? Maybe. Let's try it first. The whole thing is, if you want to do this, U.S. Congress, you have to fund it. NASA's asked to do a great many things, and this is one more thing there. I believe, as an outsider, they're just pointing out if you want to put people on the first rocket, you got to pay for it. Stand by. It's only 2017. This launch will be scheduled for 2.5 years from now. We'll see what happens. Stand by or sit.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you, Matt. Carry on.
He's the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science and planetary guy.
A long-lasting recognition of Phil's contributions to BBSO, to the university, and to the solar community. Thank you.
Thank you.
That little celebration was held in the middle of a lake, which you might think is an odd place to put a telescope. Okay, the Big Bear Solar Observatory is not quite in the middle of Big Bear Lake, but you do have to walk about 200 meters out along a rocky causeway to reach it. When I was a kid camping on the shore of that lake, I longed to visit that observatory. Well, in mid-July, I finally got my chance. The new telescope under that dome was to be rededicated as the Goody Solar Telescope. Its namesake, Phil Goody of the New Jersey Institute of Technology, was there with his family and an extended family of colleagues, former students, NJIT officials, and other fans. I was about to learn why naming this instrument after Phil was so appropriate. First, though, I was invited by Claude Plimate for a tour. Claude helped build the Goody and serves as telescope engineer and chief observer, or, as he says, telescope driver.
Wow. Okay, so this is the main dome for the now the Goody Solar Telescope as of this morning. You can see that to get a 1.6-meter telescope shoehorned into a facility that was originally designed for far, far smaller telescopes, a pair of 10-inch telescopes back in 69, a lot of work had to go into, first of all, making a very compact, very short, off-axis Gregorian cast grain telescope, as well as going from the classic hemispherical dome to this 5/8 sphere that we have now, which is a modified radar dome made out of plastic to keep it light. That's about 2 square meters of collecting area. Solar constant at the Earth's surface, somewhere around 1 kilowatt per square meter. We're collecting 2 kilowatts of power.
A lot of heat.
That's a lot of power. That's a lot of heat. And the primary focus of this telescope, F2.4 as I recall, the primary focus image is about 36 millimeters across. 2 kilowatts and 36 millimeters. That will melt metal. So the way we deal with it on a solar telescope, you have to have some kind of a heat dump.
When you say off-axis, it means that the secondary mirror, the one that the big primaries shine their light up to, it's not in the center above that the primary mirror, right?
And that's exactly right. And that's somewhat critical for solar observing in particular, because, of course, we've all seen nice on-axis telescopes like Hubble telescope images that have those beautiful star images with those beautiful diffraction spikes off of there. In solar observing, we're looking at a very bright but low contrast object. All that diffraction would decrease our contrast. So by going with an off-axis telescope, you remove that diffraction, you increase your contrast.
The resolution of what you're able to resolve on the surface of the sun, I heard a pretty amazing figure given in one of the talks we just heard.
In the visible wavelength, we are resolving about 50 kilometers across the sun.
93 million miles away.
Yes, and that may be the actual resolving limit of the sun, because keep in mind, the sun is not solid, it is nebulous, and so there is some limit to the structure size on the sun. We may be hitting that now in the visible, but that really is, we won't know for sure until the 4-meter telescope being built by the National Solar Observatory goes into operation in a few years from now, whether maybe there is more to see. I won't put my bets on that. But in the infrared, they will be able to hit the same resolving limit we have in the visible out to the infrared. So that's another partnership that is an obvious one between this telescope, which is a pathfinder to the 4-meter telescope, and on to the science that they'll be doing in the future.
And this scope, until that one comes online, this is the largest solar telescope?
It is tied for the largest solar telescope. I spent 26 years working with the National Solar Observatory at their previous flagship telescope, the McMath-Pierce Solar Telescope on Kitt Peak. It also has a 1.6-meter aperture. However, that came online in 1962. Mm-hmm. This one came online in 2009. We've learned a few things about resolving power. You've heard a lot about adaptive optics and now going into multi-conjugate adaptive optics that allows us to really take advantage of the resolving power of these large telescopes here on the Earth's surface.
We heard over and over this morning, basically, location, location, location. Why is it so special that this is in the middle of a lake?
All your listeners know about the great history of the Southern California observatories. Mount Wilson was built here. Palomar was built here. You get that wonderful laminar flow coming off the Pacific coast with our standard westerly wind. And these mountain ranges are the first ones to interrupt that flow. So most large observatories you'll see in some setup very similar to that. Of course, Mauna Kea, Hawaii, out in the middle of an ocean. The wonderful observatories down in Chile, same thing. Canary Islands, etc., etc. Well, Caltech, when they built this facility, were looking for a facility or a location that had that good astronomical scene inherently. But we are a solar observatory. We look at the sun during the day. And of course, the sun heats the ground. You get those thermals rising up around your telescope, ruining your daytime scene. The thought was, and turned out to be correct, that the lake will mitigate those thermals, preserving the natural good scene during the daytime.
I'm keeping you and Teresa, you two, from lunch. Thank you for finally getting me up here under the dome that I've been looking at ever since I was a little kid and wanting to stand right where I am now.
Well, we'll have to have you back anytime. I've been trying to get you out here for several years. As a hardcore planetary radio listener, it's an honor to have you here.
Thank you, Claude. It's a pleasure to be here.
Claude Plimate, chief observer with the Goody Solar Telescope at the Big Bear Solar Observatory. When we return, we'll meet Phil Goody. This is Planetary Radio.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Hi, I'm Kalisa with the Planetary Society. We've joined with the U.S. National Park Service to make sure everyone is ready for the 2017 North American Total Solar Eclipse. Together, we've created the new Junior Ranger Eclipse Explorer Activity Book. It helps kids learn about the science, history, and fun of eclipses. Call your nearest national park and ask if they have the Eclipse Explorer book, or you can download it from nps.gov/kids or at planetary.org/eclipse.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, taking you back up to the Big Bear Solar Observatory in California's San Bernardino Mountains. I'd been invited to join a celebration of astronomer, astrophysicist, and helioseismologist Phil Goody. Don't worry, Phil himself will soon tell us what a helioseismologist is. The Big Bear Solar Observatory belonged to the California Institute of Technology for many years, when NJIT took over the BBSO, it was Phil who saw the potential for creating our planet's most powerful solar telescope and led the effort to create it. The new instrument came online in 2009 and will remain the best telescope for learning about our star till the DKIST, the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope in Hawaii, begins observations in a couple of years. Phil became NJIT Distinguished Research Professor of Physics, founder of the Center for Solar Terrestrial Research, and director of the BBSO.
Hale, Keck, Hubble, now the Goody. That's a pretty nice community to be part of, to have a telescope facility named after you.
It's a real honor. It's a real honor. I'm in good company.
So many people had so many nice things to say about you today, and they used a lot of words like tenacity, audacity, because apparently that's what it took once NJIT took over this facility and to replace the telescope there with this amazing instrument that I just got to climb up into the dome and take a look at. Quite an accomplishment.
I always thought about myself as being tenacious. That's for sure. Audacious, that's a new one for me, but tenacious, yes.
Talk about how you came to be in charge of this facility and had the chance to achieve what's happened here.
Well, I had this observing program. I knew I needed one because when I started doing astrophysics, I didn't have a background in astronomy, and I was doing theoretical work, which you can do in sort of a narrow way, but I had to learn some astrophysics, and the best way to do that is to have an observing program. It forces you to get the background that you needed, and I came to really like observational astronomy, and the opportunity came to transfer Big Bear Solar Observatory to NJIT, and I worked hard to make it happen. It gave me the opportunity to do some things that I thought I could do without any background in doing them.
You described yourself as a helioseismologist, which was not a term I had heard before.
That's a field that started in the late 70s, and that's the study of the inside of the sun using the oscillations of the sun. It's analogous to the study of the inside of the Earth using earthquake data to probe the inside of the Earth, except that the sunquakes are continuous and enable a seismic sounding of the interior of our star.
How much better do we understand our star, the one that's easiest for us to study, in the time not just that this telescope has been operating, but, oh, I don't know, in the last 30 or 40 years as we've been studying the sun?
We understand how the sun rotates. It rotates on a single axis, not on multiple axes like people had postulated. We understand that there's not a deeply buried inclined magnetic field like people postulated. We understand how the magnetic field comes from the base of the convection zone to the surface. There are things that we don't understand so well about the solar cycle, but we do understand how small the change is in the size of the sun through the solar cycle and through time. We understand how small the change is in the temperature of the surface of the sun through the solar cycle. So we've learned a lot.
Somebody said that they think you know every screw in that telescope.
I'm not sure I know every screw in the telescope, but I do know the telescope pretty well. The instrumentation became so fantastically interesting. Things like adaptive optics are such a curiosity. You know, 40 years ago, these technologies didn't exist, so the field and the opportunities were wide open. No big new telescope had been built in the United States for observing the sun in a generation, but the technology certainly enabled it, and so it was a matter of figuring out how to bring the technologies together, raise the money, and get the basic design to do it. And in the basic design, you have to decide what technology risk you want to take. How big does it have to be? Well, it has to be at least a meter and a half, because that's what size you need to resolve the basic structures on the surface of the sun. All that's easy to say, but as people say, the devil's in the details, and then you have all kinds of interesting adventures dealing with the devil.
You had a whole bunch of people who you were responsible for who are now all across this field of heliophysics, of examining and studying the sun.
Yeah, I am really proud of the people who have passed through here, from Thomas Rimla, who's in charge of the project to build the most expensive telescope to date, Enrique Pallet, who's in charge of the scientific program at the Institute of Astrophysics in the Canaries, the most important scientific astrophysical institution in Spain, and others.
What do you hope will be the future for this facility, the Goody Solar Telescope, as we enter into a new era with this big new telescope in Hawaii, the DKIST, coming online?
In the short run, there's a bright future for at least another decade with what's called multi-conjugate adaptive optics, and that means that we'll be able to correct the atmospheric distortion over a wide field, and there are dynamical events that occur over a wide field in the sun, and they occur on a sub-second scale. We can't really probe those now. They are at the heart of the dynamics that happen on the sun, and so we will be able to probe those with the Goody Solar Telescope, and it will be the only instrument that can do that for some time to come.
Thank you so much, Phil, for taking a few minutes, and congratulations on what has happened here today, this renaming of what is now the Goody Solar Telescope.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a good day for the name Goody.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, welcoming you back to the show after our live show that we did at KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
So I'm not live?
You're alive.
Oh,
I hope that'll
God.
Do.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Tell us, what's alive in the sky?
A couple special things coming up. The yearly Perseid meteor shower peaks August 12th and 13th. With increased activity that happens several days before and after. However, viewing will be somewhat hampered by a gibbous moon, but you can still catch some bright meteors. If in a dark sky without that pesky moon, you get 60 to 100 meteors per hour, that number will be reduced, but still probably quite worth going out and hanging out. And then, of course, there's an eclipse. Did you know that, Matt?
You're joking.
Yes,
how could I have
am.
Missed this?
I know. August 21st, the Great North American Eclipse, a total solar eclipse, will cross the United States from Oregon to South Carolina. A partial eclipse will be visible from North America, Northern South America, and the western edge of Europe. Learn more at planetary.org/eclipse. Also, our website, planetary.org, under blogs, under my blogs, you can find an overview of the eclipse and other eclipses. All right, we moved on to this week in space history. It was a big week for recent Mars exploration. 10 years ago, the Phoenix mission launched, carrying, among other things, the Planetary Society's Visions of Mars mini DVD with art and literature and greetings from famous people to future explorers on Mars.
And if you know where to look, you can see that very DVD with Martian dirt piled up all over it because of sloppy work by the scoop on Phoenix.
I didn't say that. And then 2012, 5 years ago, hard to believe it's 5 years, Curiosity landed on Mars.
Wow. And going strong, in spite of a few holes in the wheels.
We move on to random space fact.
That was kind of cute.
Oh, thank you. So the first color picture from the surface of Mars from Viking 1 was processed quickly and released within hours with a blue sky. Further calibration showed the image actually should have had a reddish sky, and the image was re-released.
I was a punk standing at JPL with hundreds of other people because I'd kind of, not exactly snuck in, but I got in. And that first image came out. I remember saying to people, a blue sky. Mars has blue skies.
Yeah, it's a lot of people said, I think. And then, oops.
Yeah, pink is nice too.
and it's different. It's charming in its own different kind of a way.
Yeah, I kind of prefer it now.
All right, we move on to the trivia contest. I asked you, by mass, what is the fourth most common element in the sun? How'd we do, Matt?
A terrific response. I thought this one would, you know, be held back a little bit, but a lot of people either knew or looked it up. And we got an entry from Robert Sartain of Wallingford, Pennsylvania, that was chosen by random.org as our winner. He says carbon is the fourth most present element in the sun.
That is correct. After the very dominant hydrogen, quite a bit of helium, a little bit of oxygen, and then a little bit of carbon.
And not much of anything else, huh?
No, it's all downhill from there. I mean, there's other stuff mixed in.
Robert Sartain, congratulations. You are the big winner of the brand new Chop Shop Planetary Radio T-shirt. I am wearing it at this moment. Mine finally came. Everybody,
dang it! I've been telling everyone not to let you have it.
We had people lit up in arms. They were going to march on Chop Shop and the Planetary Society, but I assured them that the shirt was on its way, and I am a proud wearer of it now. And we're going to give one away again in this new contest that you're going to name in a moment, along with the 200-point iTelescope.net account, the worldwide nonprofit network of telescopes that Robert will now be able to use to observe the universe, and a cheap but effective pair of Bill Nye eclipse glasses. Dave Fairchild, the poet laureate of Planetary Radio. The sun is made of hydrogen and helium, of course, with oxygen the next in line, but Bruce asks, what is fourth? The element of graphite. It's the stuff of diamonds made. It's carbon, just another proof of star stuff we are made.
Oh.
So that completes it. We got, you know, tons of other great entries. I could go on, but we've got other things to do, including the new contest.
All right, I'm going to turn our focus over the next coming weeks to solar eclipses, not surprisingly. So with a solar eclipse, just before totality, the sun is blocked, except for sunlight streaming through lunar valleys along the limb. Who are these brief, bright beads of light named after? Go to planetary.org/radio contest. And apparently my dog wants to know,
yeah.
Right?
Is that one of your dogs raising his paw to answer the question?
It is. He's actually thumping his tail to say, hey, I know. And now he lay back down. So his excitement was brief but passionate.
I am so hoping to see those beads, which will be named when we answer this contest. How do people enter, did you say?
Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 9th, that would be Wednesday, August 9th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to enter this one and get that same terrific package of prizes. And we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, think about Max and other dogs and the weird noises they make. Hey, Max. Oh.
Nobody eclipses Max. That's Bruce Betts, though, his sort of master. He's also the director of science and technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up.
Oh.
That's not Max. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its sunny members. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.